here, just so that all folks are on the same page, Chair Hoberg is out because she's not feeling well today. And so she and I did have an opportunity to speak early today, and she says she's comfortable with us going forward, and that she will get all the information if there's a handout or anything, and she's more than sure that Representative Lesh and the others will talk to her about what information they find out today. Today's session is really focused on law enforcement, right? And so just to put it in context, and so I can answer any questions before we get someone from law enforcement to come up and testify, we know that the Senate has 90 days as a retention number. The House has zero. In light of the fact that the Senate was anticipating retaining the information for a prescribed number of days, which is 90 in our bill, we also put some, what I like to call some safeguards in the proposed legislation as a way to create a bulwark against any sort of like fishing expeditions. How can we make sure that we have a responsible process, and so that if any information is requested or if the data is requested, that there's a legitimate, for lack of a better word, criminal purpose or investigative purpose for that request, right? And so, again, the reason why I'm framing it that way, because therein lies the biggest difference between the House bill and the Senate bill, really is around the issue of retention. So that's why the focus of the discussion today is going to be with law enforcement, and they have a proposal along with the Senate's bill that they've outlined. Feel free to ask any questions. If you have any questions about any language that could potentially be, you know, looked upon that may make you feel a little better about any retention or whatever this group decides to do. So with that being said, we will have
Commander Reed.
Commander Reed, if you go up there, sir, and grab a chair, and for the record, introduce yourself, and then you can go forward. I know there's a proposal that's been sort of floating around, and if you want to go through that line by line, that'd be great, and then we can answer any questions that, or you'll be able to answer any questions that any of the committee members might have. So with that, introduce yourself for the record, and let's go.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair, my name is Commander Kenneth Reed from the St. Paul Police Department. I'm here representing the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association today. As the chairman mentioned, there are safeguards and restrictions on the use of a license plate reader that are contained, some in the House and some in the Senate versions, and I'd like to kind of go through those because these in aggregate are very strong, and I think that it helps to address the concerns about the balance of data retention, law enforcement purposes, and the public privacy issues. First, all LPR data must be destroyed no later than 90 days from the time of collection unless it becomes part of an active criminal investigation. All ALPR data is classified as confidential data, which is a big piece to this, and anyone who is aware of the history of the ALPR data and this issue knows how important that is. There are new protections for safe at home participants. A new log, which is public, containing specific times of the day that ALPR data is collected, the aggregate number of vehicles or license plates that the data are collected for each period of active use, and for a reader at a stationary location, the location where the reader was actively collecting data. Some stationary locations need to remain confidential under some sort of exception due to security issues, which we've discussed at other hearings, and I don't know that, and I apologize that I wasn't here available yesterday. I'm not sure where we are on that, sir.
So just for a moment, Commander Reed, can you talk a little more about that? There was some extensive discussion yesterday about the notion of security data, and it's my understanding that a part of the concern is that there are locations that law enforcement wishes to keep private or secret, for lack of a better word, right? But then under the Data Practices Act, that there is this fear that law enforcement will always revert to that whole security notion in order to shield information. So can you talk a little more about that and give us a little more detail around what secure locations are you talking about and why you why is that important?
First off, it's not law enforcement, in addressing your question, sir, it's not law enforcement's intention to make anything secure or confidential or hide anything unless it is absolutely necessary. Some of the issues that we are aware of, and we became aware of through an earlier round of hearings, was that there are critical infrastructure that have used LPR or may use ALPR, that they don't want the bad guys, to be frank, to know where they have them located. Otherwise, they could be defeated, and other means to access these critical infrastructure areas. And I'm referring to such facilities as the Mall of America, the Monticello Nuclear Power Plant, those types of installations which have been deemed critical infrastructure that and I don't even know which of those types of facilities are using or have used ALPR. It's the issue of they don't want those types of installations defeated by people who are intent on doing that. And by making known the locations of their ALPR devices, whether fixed or mobile, we're giving an advantage where none should be given.
So critical infrastructure, that's really what you're looking at when you think in terms of information that should not be provided because there's some national security risk or some security risk, is that right?
Yes, it's law enforcement's intent for the general use of ALPR that those are publicly known locations.
All right. Senator Hayden.
So, Commander, how do you make that decision? Is it of the discretion of your organization, or is there some methodology that says this, infrastructure is critical, and thus we would not like to let everybody know where our LPR devices are, or is it based on an alert status? We think that there's credible, information that says something. How do we make that decision? It seems a little nebulous to me.
Commander Reed.
Mr. Chair, Senator, for the most part, it is all under when the Department of Homeland Security, there's a structure, an infrastructure that makes that designation on what particular business or installation is a piece of critical infrastructure. We have no say in that other than we are asked to inventory from time to time our buildings and businesses and so that they can take that further and deem whether one is constituted as a piece of critical infrastructure. That's not to say that it's all permanent buildings or installations. For example, on a presidential visit, that could be considered, and it comes under a security classification where they would say this matches that type of requirement where it would be a security classification. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Senator
Mr.
Hayden.
Chair, Commander Reed, so is that information classified? In other words, what would be critical, a critical building or whatever, is that classified as well? So I guess where I'm getting at is we don't necessarily know what is critical infrastructure, and then thus we don't know what devices are attached to the critical infrastructure.
It is my understanding, and this is an area I don't work real close with, but it is my understanding that it is not classified necessarily.
Okay.
Which infrastructure would be, that's been publicly available, I know, in the past. On those instances where it may come up on a short-term basis, that may or may not be publicly, they may not make a public pronouncement that this is a critical event. But in most cases, in my experience, they have.
And just to make sure that I'm clear, Officer Commander Reed, when there's that information or that language in the Senate bill that talks about security notions that you are talking about critical infrastructure places where these LPRs may be utilized that would not be disclosed but for their national security focus or this critical infrastructure idea. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, that is exactly what we were trying to accomplish, yes.
All right. And you may continue unless someone else has a question. Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, if this was stated in response to Senator Hayden's questions, but did you say, Commander Reed, who's the list of people who will be privy to these locations? Did you already answer that?
I didn't answer
Commander
that,
Reed.
Mr. Chair. I did not answer it in that manner, sir. No. And I don't have an exclusive list of who would be privy in those rare events that it would be private.
Okay.
I don't have the answer to that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, sorry for disrupting your flow, so you can continue.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair, to continue with the list of new restrictions that are included and that we support, the law enforcement agency must maintain logs showing the date the data was collected and how the data was classified, in other words, whether it's a hit or a non-hit. The next item would be if the LPR data may only be shared with another law enforcement agency if that agency complies with the 90-day retention period. Law enforcement has put their heads together and suggests that the requesting agency also must provide a reasonable suspicion basis for the request and a case file number as part of that request.
Just to make certain there, so when you say that there's a 90-day retention period, you're saying within that prescribed amount of time, if another law enforcement agency requests the information, the 90 days still keeps tolling, for lack of a better word.
That's a perfect word, right?
Yeah. Tolling. And you all are suggesting, in addition to the request from another agency, they must also do the same thing, which is provide a case number or a legitimate reason or reasonable suspicion basis for the request. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, I just want to ask for some clarification. The word tolling is a good word, but it leaves some room. And I think what we're saying, and you correct me if I'm wrong, is that the original 90 days stands as it is. In other words, when the data is read and collected, that 90-day period starts. Somewhere within there, they make a request based upon reasonable suspicion, provide their case file number so that we can verify that if necessary. And then the 90 days expires, it has to expire on their end as well.
Yes.
The only difference, the difference is, and this the other part of the language, is that if it becomes part of an active criminal investigation, whether that's in our shop or theirs, that then applies.
Exactly.
So that's exactly what we mean. Yes, sir.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a question about when it actually goes to an active investigation. So if I have done all of this data reading, and then I have that for a case, right? Maybe one of the cars, something happened in an area, and one of the cars, I believe that the defendant was in one of those cars. But the defense attorney might want access to the data of who else was there to point to an alternative perpetrator. So when you actually have the data that you're going to use, what happens with all that other data in that 90 days? Because ultimately the defense attorney is going to want to know who else was in the area.
Commander Reed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, it is the question of what becomes evidence in using LPR has been something that we haven't spent a lot of time addressing. When the car, as it stands now and the way this looks, when someone has reasonable suspicion to search the data, they find information that's applicable to their criminal investigation, that data now becomes retained, for lack of a better description, and it retained through whatever the course and under the Data Practices Act, you know, for the course of the investigation plus the time for appeal. So that's always. Those non-hit cars, unless it was pertinent to that particular search, any non-hit car would be purged. So it's the pertinence to the search that seems to be, that would be the clear line. But anything beyond that is going to be purged.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that that's something that we really need to think about as we're talking about this bill, because we think about this in terms of, like, stolen cars. You don't get a hit on a car, and so it's not stolen, and so then all that data is purged after 90 days. But imagine that it's a situation of a rape case, right? And it happened in a location, and so you're interested in who was in the area at the time. Maybe you have DNA, and so you get a hit, right? And then you end up going back to see who was, or proving who was in that area. If you've purged all that other data, that's all gone, Mr. Chair. So we should at least think about that in terms of this data, and not just think about it in terms of a stolen car or not a stolen car.
Mr. Chair.
Understood. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commander Reed, then, on her scenario, how long are you recommending we keep that data? A rape case like that. Did you hear her scenario well?
Mm-hmm. I did, and I still have a question in my mind on which data. If we're talking about the query itself and the return of the query, then all of that should be kept along with the case file for the duration of the criminal case and any appeals periods. That would be our recommendation.
Representative Lesh.
So, Representative Hillstrom, were you referring to a court's consideration of what should be discoverable by the defense for potentially exculpatory evidence?
Right.
And I think that's actually a great point that hasn't been brought up in, I think, any of our previous hearings, but I can absolutely envision, well, the government gets to look at all these individuals for whom they didn't have reasonable suspicion previously or even probable cause, and put it together based upon circumstantial evidence, and then get their charge, after which the data's gone, and then the charge gets brought, and then a defense attorney comes in and says, Judge, there's absolutely no reason why my client shouldn't have the same benefit of being able to look at this stuff to defend ourselves against it. I think that's a very real possibility. I wonder who the first judge would be who would invalidate this law because a defendant is entitled to their full defense and potentially exculpatory evidence. So mm-hmm. I don't know if there's anyone here who even has an answer for that. But
I don't think, Representative Lesh, I don't think any of us will have a complete answer for that, because it's territory that seems to be new territory for us to consider, right? Because we've been focusing on whether one person gets a hit or not, and then if it's retained for this 90 days, what happens if it becomes a part of a criminal investigation? Now that creates a different question as to then how much of that information should be retained for purposes of going forward. So that's something that the committee should think about. Senator Hall, you were looking for something? You need help?
No, I'm just, we've got a final vote on the Wolf bill. So if you're interested, just going down there.
So did they put anything on the Wolf bill? Because I don't think they put anything on that bill.
I have no idea.
Okay.
But if you guys aren't going, I'm not going.
No, I'm not going down.
I'm sorry.
Okay, so, all right, so any other questions on this point, unless we will let Commander Reed continue. Okay, go ahead, Commander
Reed. Okay, Mr. Chair. To continue with it, one of the requirements as well that's been added is a biennial audit required. Compliance with data practices, data access requirements are involved. One of the new restrictions is that the responsible authority establishes written procedures to ensure that law enforcement personnel have access to data only with written authorization from the sheriff, chief, or their designee.
I'm sorry to stop you again, Commander Sir. Reed. Commander Reed, one of the things that have been expressed to me is concern about there being no uniformed procedure by which to access or retain this data. Are you concerned that maybe a sheriff or a police department would have a different written policy to establish how that information should be retained in training? Or is there some uniform policy or idea that you all use that would be helpful in making sure that we don't have as much inconsistency?
Mr. Chair,
Commander Reed.
With all the provisions, these restrictions that I'm listing out that are contained within the Senate and the House bills, if these were to become law, all law enforcement agencies would look to that law to formulate their policies. In anticipation of that, we have drafted a policy that would mirror this information in the bills, and that we would disseminate. We're prepared to disseminate that out to all law enforcement agencies as a guide for them. I say that there's a caveat to that, in that different law enforcement agencies have different formats for their policies. They have different ways of doing that. Some use an electronic policy thing called Lexapol. We at St. Paul, we don't use that. We formulate our own policies and procedures in a certain format. So we have that draft policy. I actually have a copy here that could be provided for everyone that we put together for law enforcement to use. And it's written as it stands right now with these current bills on the table. So any changes?
Commander Reed, that would be great. I'm sure that you don't have bionic vision or anything, and I can hold this up and you can say, oh, yeah, that's it. But can I have this handed to you and you can look at this and see if this is it? If so, then we'll make copies of it. But if not, then we'll make a copy of what you have, if
Very
that's
good,
okay.
Sir.
Jonay, did you see what they're going to give us so we can get copy?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
In answer to your question, that was an incomplete version of it, so she'll make the full copies.
Okay, great. So would you like us to just wait a minute so we can all get that, and maybe we, or do you want to finish going through this and then we can go through that policy that you have, or
what
would you like to do?
That's at your pleasure, sir.
All right, well, you know what, let's wait 1 minute and we'll get that. So since we're there on this sheet, then it makes better sense for us to keep going down it once we have all the information. Emily, did you guys get a copy?
I actually do.
And then will you make sure Commander Reed gets his copy back and everything? Commander Reed needs his copy. Your name. There you go. All right, so Commander Reed, since we're at this place where we're talking about some sort of uniform policy, this is something similar as to what you are suggesting would go to law enforcement so that there'd be some uniformity, and you derive this from, you know, thinking about what this legislation, if passed, would really want you all to do. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
So would you take us through this draft, ALPR?
Yes, sir, I will, Mr. Chair and members. The first part is the purpose and scope. And most police department policies start out with a scope statement, and this kind of talks about what is the APL equipment is intended for, and what it would operate as. The next section is the data collection and retention section. It brings in that the main big part of that is that it's only to be used for legitimate law enforcement purposes. Entry of the data shall be prohibited unless approved by a supervisor. So that covers the situation where we have, in the past, have allowed our officers to actually enter data into the LPR system, a license plate to look for under situations for Amber Alert. And that's the only one that we've ever allowed in St. Paul, but others, you know, there can be robberies and things like that that they want to, but it has to be supervisory approval to do that. They cannot do that on their own, on their own initiative. An important statement to us about verifying all alerts is essential prior to taking any action on an ALPR system hit. And there's a reason for that, because there is the way the state has set up the ALPR data system and our connection, law enforcement's connection with those databases, is there is a lag time, and it could be anywhere from 2 to 12 hours that data, new data has been imported into the system. So it's incumbent on the officer to check and verify with their radio channel that that alert or that hit is still valid before they take enforcement action on it. The chief of police or the head of law enforcement agency or their designee is responsible for the proper collection and retention of the data. And this talks about not allowing data to be stored. This is a little technical piece, but the database, the ALPR makes that connection with the state database, makes that read on whether it's a hit or not. And then that date information, when it reads the plate on the car, gets stored on board system in the squad car. We don't want a long lag between when that goes up to the server where it's ultimately stored, because that's where your 90-day period is pretty critical. So we have put a limiting factor in there that it can't be stored indefinitely on the mobile data thing. It has to get up to the server. That all ALPR data is stored no more than 90 days and must be purged unless it becomes part of an investigative file. We've spoken about that. And then the safe at home participant protections that we've helped get authored in these bills, that we must honor that if they make that request. The next section comes into administration of the ALPR data. And this is where we are saying that chiefs or heads of law enforcement agency should assign a personnel administrator to administrate the day-to-day operation of ALPR operations, provide for training and documentation of that training, and we specify a little bit about what that training should have. Only designated personnel authorized in writing by the chief law enforcement operator will have access to ALPR data, and only for official, legitimate, and documented law enforcement purposes. I talked about the training. They'll also be responsible for maintaining required records and required records that, as specified in the bills related to ALPR use, and we've outlined what those records, as we've defined already, what those are. We've added a specific section about including the following: the authorized user of the data, the date and time the data was accessed, the legitimate law enforcement purpose, and that has to include the reasonable factual basis for accessing the data, and the associated case number. And then we talk again about stationary locations, and that those would be logged insofar, except to the extent that they would be those that what we previously spoke about, the security situations. We also have a specific section on accountability and safeguards, which which we're talking about the technological part of that, in that there has to be a login, password protected logins to the mobile workstation and to the server, that all non-law enforcement requests for ALPR data shall be referred to the responsible authority and handled in accordance with applicable law. Data released to other law enforcement officials, which we've also previously spoken about, when the request is in writing, supported by reasonable suspicion, and including the case or file number from that agency. And then we also would put in the policy that the records retention of those written requests, so we would recommend 3 years. And that the auditing on a biennial basis. That would be our policy. Now, much more would have to be done in procedures, which is a little different, as everyone here, I'm sure, is aware, in terms of how you set up your APR and the use of it and stuff like that.
Any questions on the draft notion around the policy? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commander Reed, what is the threshold for opening a case file in the St. Paul Police Department?
Commander Reed.
We would have, the threshold would be that we have a report of a crime, and whether that's a report by a citizen or a report by an officer.
Representative Lesh.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess what I'm trying to get at is I'm trying to determine standards and thresholds for access to this data to avoid the obvious concerns that have already been stated at this table that could happen, and of course have happened in the past. For example, if you had a problem with your neighbor, is there anything in police department policy prohibiting you from opening a case file on your neighbor?
Commander Reed.
There is nothing. You can make a report to the police department. Whether or not we would choose to open that up as a crime and a report that we would assign investigative resources to, no, not likely, unless we had some criminal damage or some other criminal element that would take it to where we would open that up as an investigative case.
Well, Mr. Chair, Commander Reed, bear with me for a minute, because I'm not really asking if you would do it. I have a lot of respect and a strong faith in the City of St. Paul Police Department. I've worked with them, for all of you, for 13 years, and you do outstanding work. So I'm not really asking if you would open it, but I'm asking if maybe a different administration in a different year could use this same policy to potentially systematically track individuals who are not popular, have a problematic political opinion, or anything like that. And my concern is if the only threshold is that it be connected to a case number or there be a legitimate law enforcement purpose, it just strikes me as it doesn't make me comfortable. It certainly makes me comfortable for the folks that are in charge now, but we got to make a law for folks that may be in charge not now. So that's the reason for my question, and I don't know if you have a response to that or not, but you certainly don't need to respond. It's more of a statement for me.
Anything, Commander Reed, on that? Or?
I think...
Yeah, we'll definitely think about that. So I'm sorry, but I'll come touch base with you when you come back.
Mr. Chair, my colleagues have been helping me try to formulate an answer that would be helpful. When we respond to calls for service, that's our primary way of doing things, but we also do traffic enforcement and stuff like that. For example, when we stop a car, it's based upon reasonable suspicion. When we get a call for service, we look at that in context of does it have any criminal elements to make it something that we would work upon. Those, whether or not we chose to take it further to an investigative step, are public information. Our calls for service, who called, what was about, are all public information. It's only once we make that decision to become a criminal investigation that data classification changes. And again, we're at the part that at the point that a crime was reported and it's likely that a crime occurred. I hope that helps clarify where we're at in terms of what does the reporting of a crime and how does that access go from there.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commander, I'm looking at the fourth paragraph down where it talks about the transfer of ALPRs from the vehicles to your database, if I understand that right. And it can't exceed 30 days. That seems like a long time. I would think you'd do that almost daily, but what's the practical side to that? Because, I mean, the information is not good, is it? Unless it's transferred to the
true. And
Commander
Chair, Mr. Representative Hall, and it's a good point, although what it does is make allowances for things that happen in the day-to-day. We crash a lot of squad cars over the course of the year, not by choice, and most of the time we're the crashee, or the crash, we're the one on the receiving end. But with these ALPR, what happens is that's out to PSG. We don't have the wireless accessibility to make that transfer, so it's really a practical limitation. Okay. For most parts, we do it on a day-to-day basis. As soon as one of our, in St. Paul, and it's different setups with different vendors, ALPR vendors and different agencies, but as soon as they hit a wireless spot, that's uploading. I mean, so it's within that 24-hour period. But they're practically, we have had situations where that it doesn't happen. So that's why we kind of recommended 30 days. It has to be done.
Senator Hayden.
That's the reason, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commander Reed, who does the biennial audits?
Commander Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is where, again, I apologize for not having been here yesterday. In previous versions of this, and correct me if I'm wrong, was originally spelled out as the public safety.
So it's my understanding, in the Senate bill, it would be the Department of Public Safety.
And in the other version, it's internal auditing.
And I think the Department of Public Safety, if my memory serves me correctly, I think they had some concern about their ability to do those audits. And I think that is also connected to the potential costs. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce my colleague here, and I think he can give a more complete answer on that.
And if you introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, Mr. Chair, my name is Drew Evans. I'm the Assistant Superintendent at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. We conduct the majority of the auditing functions for the Department of Public Safety for our databases, and that would be our position as well, that the difficulty in auditing these is St. Paul, different agencies have purchased proprietary systems that belong to those agencies, and the systems that we typically audit are BCA-owned and operated systems, so we understand them, we understand how to access them, we provide that. So it would be difficult for us to provide meaningful audits on proprietary systems that we don't have access to throughout the state for these law enforcement agencies.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Hayden.
So I don't want to go too long, because I know we're working through this bill and we've lost some of our House members. But are the audits primarily, what can you just give me a sense of the audit? Because I know that yesterday we had there's this issue about who gets to see the data, and I know Representative Lesh talked a lot about this idea of making sure that the person who sees the data really is the right person, and not that we're not on these phishing, these phishing expeditions or other issues, or people have personal vendettas or whatever's going. So is the audit really looking to ensure that the people who look at the data are the ones that are supposed to be, and they're looking at it for its intended purpose? Is that kind of how your organization works?
Commander Reed.
Mr. Chair, given the restrictions that are in this bill, if these were put in place, we would definitely be auditing for accessibility issues, who accessed, for what purpose, and then we would take that to look at the case number to make sure that that matched up. So we would probably, because I've been involved with a number of audits, it might be where we're just picking out some exemplars from that to make sure that we're doing that. Obviously, we'd be looking at volume as part of our audit. If you have one particular person who's accessing it over and over and over again, that's going to raise a red flag for us. We do financial and fraud audits on a regular basis, so we have people that are familiar with auditing procedures, know what to look for in that. The other thing we would be looking for in these audits would be the 90-day retention issue. I mean, if there's non-hit data that's over 90 days within the system, right then and there, we're going to know that we have a problem, whether it's with the data, the software itself, or if it's we haven't set the trigger correctly or something along those lines. So those are the issues that are in the legislation, the issues that I'm listing out that we would be auditing for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commander Reed, my question relates specifically to the auditing. And it relates to how the department is going to deal with the results of an audit when that audit presents some maybe less than favorable information. Let me use an example. About 20 years ago, there was a study in St. Paul that was attempting to measure your likelihood of being stopped based upon your race. And as I recollect, the study, again, it's a long time ago, so bear with me. The study controlled for population, controlled for geography, all the normal statistics you would want to control for. It stated you were 13 times more likely to get pulled over if you were African American, for example, than if you were white. Now, I think there were a lot of policies instituted since then in the St. Paul Police Department and departments across the state, for that matter. To try to adopt best practices that would address that. And I think we've alleviated a lot of any of the problems that could have existed that would have led to a study like that. However, we are proposing now to put in place a system that tracks individuals, not based upon the individual decision of an officer to stop that vehicle, but indiscriminately based upon a system that tracks everyone. And we know that you drive by, for example, and we know that there are more squad cars, for example, in populations or geographic areas of the city that have populations of color. Those in my city, Frogtown, for example, East Side, some areas that I represent, and I wonder what is the reaction going to be with, say, the police department, St. Paul, or any department, from your estimation, when an audit comes back saying that we have information on the whereabouts and movements of people of color. 13 times, 15 times, 20 times more than we do of the white residents of St. Paul. I can imagine that there would probably be some issues if those statistics and numbers were to come out. And I'd be willing to bet that just knowing how this system is going to function right now, that audit will come out and that will be the press. And how would you deal with that if you were chief at the time? Yeah, I guess I would leave it at that. That's my question.
Commander Reed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benton, I mean, you opened up a very complicated question. I was here 20 years ago when that study was done, and I know what happened and what those procedures were and how that flagged a few individuals that needed further looking at their activities, and that was done. I know that it resulted in an agreement with the NAACP that helped put us on the path to make sure that we were addressing those community concerns. The ALPR data, when we're talking about that here, keep in mind that what we're talking about is that that non-hit data is gone after 90 days. That's a big restriction on the availability of that data and the applicability of that data for anything other than law enforcement reasons. And the fact that we are making it confidential data, which was a big concern for law enforcement, that we don't want people to access this data and have it for nefarious purposes. We want to use it for our public safety, our public safety reasons and our mission. If that, one of the things that happens is, and I heard what you said about where ALPR is used, and one has to understand that we respond to crime trends. For example, our purpose, primary purpose of ALPR use in St. Paul is auto theft. So we deploy those units to officers who are looking in areas where autos are stolen, where are they recovered, and on transportation routes, which vary over time because bad guys, once they feel the presence, they adjust and then we adjust. It's that old cat and mouse game. So those stretches or geographic locations are going to get the predominant amount of reads for some period of time. The same is true with our parking enforcement. We deploy an ALPR with our parking enforcement officers for one of our biggest complaints in St. Paul is traffic and parking. Grand Avenue, University Avenue, the major parking things, the downtown business area, get the predominant amount of attention on with our ALPR units. There's going to be that, but we also, that's all predicated on where are the calls for service and where are the crimes occurring. And that's how we deploy our resources and that's how we deploy our units, keeping in mind the element of that crime occurs throughout our city geographically, and we have to make allowances for that in our deployment decisions. How I as a chief would be, I don't know that I can speculate about what I would do if I was a chief, because I'm not, and I don't envision being one, so.
Well, thank you.
Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the response, Commander Reed. I have no idea. I mean, it was a shot in the dark question, too, because I don't know how I would respond either. I think it's going to be tough, because like you said, you respond to where the crime is. I remember this must have been right when I first started becoming a prosecutor. There was a smash and grab down at R.F. Moeller Jewelers on Ford Parkway in St. Paul. Mm-hmm. And Highland Park, around Ford Parkway in St. Paul, has a higher property tax value homes. There, it has a whiter population, a more highly educated population, a wealthier population. And they demanded that they get a stronger police presence at the time. Well, there were no Western District squads rolling through Highland Park during the day at the time. It would just, I mean, the numbers did not justify, the numbers for the calls and the numbers for the incident did not justify a squad being out there. But sure enough, Chief Finney designated a Highland beat car, and they had a beat car rolling up and down Ford Parkway for PR, essentially what it was. And the rest of the squads were congregated around where you're getting the calls, because at that point, all you're doing is responding to calls. And if that's where the squads are congregated, then there's no question that the registered owner of the vehicles for those plates that have the images are going to be a lot higher percentage of people of color. And I don't know if there's any way around that, but I do expect that if this is to be implemented, that an audit like that will come out and press like that will come out, and I have no idea how I would deal with that either, so no need for a response. But
All right, any other questions before we'll let Commander Reed continue on with off the first sheet? Because where we left off was we were talking about their policies and procedures, and then I see that there's a bullet point that says access may be obtained only for a specific law enforcement purpose, and I guess you would like to start there.
Mr. Chair, yes, I did leave off at that point. Access may be obtained by a specific law enforcement purpose, and we have suggested that we would accept that further restriction, and which we've talked about in the purposes of the bill, that access based only upon reasonable suspicion and a record of the reasonable factual basis for the query and the associated case number be recorded and be logged, for example.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Howell.
On that point, Commander, who can access records on a law enforcement position? There's a central database for all of this. Do we get federal enforcement that can look at that? Do we get international enforcement if we get Canada, if they need some of those or would like to look at those? Who has access to that?
Commander
may not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way the system is set up in Minnesota, each agency has its own data. So we are not feeding it into a central repository of data.
Okay.
Other states have, or other locales within other states have chosen to do that. That's not how this is set up in Minnesota currently. So we have the access to the data. So for example, St. Paul, only St. Paul can access the data. And as we've previously talked about, under this would be a system, if these bills were enacted, where it would be written authorization by the chief of police or their designee. It would be an administrator that would take ownership of access of that data and make sure those records are. If we had a request from another agency that had a crime, that had a genesis, for example, or maybe traveled through the city of St. Paul, you understand that in our metropolitan area with 27 suburban agencies and two major metropolitan areas, a lot of our crime traverses jurisdictions all the time. So it would not be unusual to have someone say, hey, we had a green Chevy with a partial plate of LPR that left this robbery in Minneapolis. It was spotted on the Ford Parkway in St. Paul. Can you check and see if you had any LPR hits on that and anything similar to that? But they would have to have a written request to us based and that cited their reasonable suspicion for making the access request and having their associated case or file number with it. Again, so for the point that down the road, if there was a question about why was that access and for what purpose, that we can check that, whether that's part of an audit or if some question elsewhere came up about that particular instance. But yes, that would be applied to any other jurisdiction that would have that situation come
outside up. Outside of the state?
I could foresee it pretty rarely outside of the state, but it wouldn't preclude it. Wisconsin's 15, 18 miles away. We do have those from time to time. But it's not a common occurrence for us, but obviously for the city of Stillwater or something like that, that would be much more. I know that we have had situations with our interstate system, 94 up to Fargo-Moorhead, 90 across the state, that we've had requests. We know about a situation where a car came with a load of narcotics across from Highway 90 up and was supposed to be in the Twin Cities area. Okay, what's the, I could foresee, this is not a case where they made a request for ALPR, but I could certainly foresee that.
Mr. Chair. Any follow-up, Senator?
Follow-up on that. If a scenario was that, there was a big case and someone said that was being accused of whatever, kidnapping, murder, or whatever, and they said, no, I was in Burnsville, or I was in St. Paul, would they have access or their lawyers have access to your records to see if there was a hit for them in St. Paul?
Mr. Chair.
Commander Reed.
To to the subject of exonerating people, we have had situations where ALPR data has been accessed and used to prove exactly that, that they were not in an area or that they were in an area lawfully and weren't involved in any of the criminal activity. I'm sorry, I just lost your question a moment.
Senator Hall, maybe he can ask you another question. My job, you remember, Commander Reed. Senator Hall.
A quick one. How long might it be before someone gives you that kind of request? I mean, is that 60 days out, or you'd never get that? You'd only get it within the first 30 days.
Mr. Chair.
Commander Reed.
Thank you. It did jog my memory, and I appreciate that. In terms of the structure of these restrictions, if it was a non-hit, in other words, we weren't acting upon anything that happened with that ALPR data, after 90 days, it would be gone.
Yeah.
So if they did not make their request within that 90-day time period, and it was something applicable to their criminal investigation, it would be gone. It would no longer be useful.
Okay.
Any other follow-up before Commander Reed keeps going? Okay, you keep going, Commander Reed. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, to finish out our list of restrictions on license plate reader data that we have collated from these two bills, the law enforcement must notify the BCA within 10 days of installation or current use of an ALPR. And the BCA must maintain a list of agencies using ALPRs, including the location of stationary readers, unless that location disclosure, again, as we've talked about, is a security data issue. So this list of restrictions is very comprehensive. I have, if I may, I have been involved in this issue since 2007 when we first started researching getting ALPRs, and I've looked at many abstracts and articles and statutes about ALPR data retention and management and accountability. And this is a very, very strong list of those things, management and accountability, from our perspective, from law enforcement's perspective, that we think very much addresses, along with the 90-day retention period, along with the designation of the data as confidential, addresses and creates the balance between the legitimate privacy concerns and our legitimate mission as in public safety. And so we feel real strongly that this is a really good list contained within these and put into policy by the agencies that choose to use the ALPR. We feel really good about it.
Thank you so very much, Commander Reed. Any other questions for Commander Reed or Mr. Evans from DPS? Are you guys sure? Okay, I want to make sure that you have all the information. All right, and I believe that you two are going to be the only two from law enforcement testifying today, kind of going through the standards and procedures and answering any questions that we may have as to what would be the appropriate mechanisms to be put in place for record retention. Anything else? Thank you so very much.
Mr. Chair, you're welcome. Thank you.
All right. We said today was only going to be an opportunity for law enforcement to testify. Because we remember when we met the other day, we allowed Mr. Neumeister and others to testify, and at the end of that sitting is when we started with law enforcement, but we had to leave and go to session and other things. Is there any other request from any member around the table before we get ready to adjourn?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Lesh.
I think Representative Hillstrom raised a great point that I hadn't considered before. When we're collecting data like this, and we use it to affect a prosecution, and then we immediately remove the ability of a defense attorney to use like evidence collected by the state for exculpatory purposes, as cited by Senator Hulk, we potentially run into a huge problem, and that's what we have got to probably solve. For the HIT data, I don't think it's as much of a problem because we have independent probable cause or reasonable suspicion for that. It works the same way as we do for any other case. Mm-hmm. But for non-HIT data, when we use the data specifically to bootstrap in a charge or a complaint, I fully expect if I'm a defense attorney and they charge a client of mine with something based upon this information, and I go back and demand that that same process and technology be used to discover exculpatory evidence, and then the state says, well, no, we destroyed it, that's a major, major issue. I run into this time and time again, whether you're talking about 911 tapes, because typically there's a 90-day rule for destruction of 911 tapes, but it's a major issue. It still remains a major issue. But with 911 tapes, you're just talking about the tape itself. It could result in exculpatory evidence. I think we really have to examine this and consider this. Obviously, if we go to a retention period, any kind of retention period is an issue because that purports that there will at some point be a destruction after which the exculpatory evidence will not be available. So I haven't looked at the law recently with regard to how we deal with the destruction of state evidence. I do know that in the city attorney's office, we're on for our emails, we have some kind of permanent retention plan, right? It has to be kept almost forever. Some email where I email my boss and saying, hey, the Culligan man hasn't brought the new water tank in yet, okay? It's retained for like 1,000 years because if you don't, the judge will throw out a case or something, okay? So this is something that I want to explore between now and our next hearing.
And so, Senator Hayden.
Well, it does bring up an issue, and I don't know, it's more of a technical issue about, you know, destruction. Is it really destroyed, or is it just, or can you forensically go back and bring this stuff back, or is there, and I don't know enough about how people work, but I have, you know, you always hear the, it's never really gone, a conversation, and so I think that's definitely helpful.
Commander Reed, you
may. Mr. Chair, if I could address Senator Hayden's question. Once it's purged, it is gone. It is not retrievable. It would take, the way that the software systems from the vendors have been set up, it is gone and overwritten, and it's not something that you can forensically even get back.
Thank you, Commander Reed. Anything else? If not, here's the plan. The plan is, I'm sure the Representative Lesh is going to talk to Representative Holberg, and we will probably talk tomorrow. Hopefully, we can try to get together tomorrow, and then that will be just for the committee then to start going through the bills and seeing if we have a meeting of the minds, and then others obviously can listen in, and if there's a question that the committee has and wants to call someone forward to get some clarity on a specific notion, then we will then allow the public to testify only upon invitation, as opposed to someone from the public just saying, I want to testify. Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, I would like to hear from public defenders and prosecutors to see, in relation to what we were talking about, to see how long they think we should retain that information. Oh. If 90 days is enough, you know, reasonable, or if that's just way too little.
All right, and I know Nancy Haas is here, so that's a request to get a prosecutor here tomorrow. And then I will talk to someone from public defenders. Who has more contact with the public defender's office? Okay, I will call the contact. Hey, somebody got to put the public defenders around here. I don't know about you prosecutors and everything, right? But I will try to get someone from the public defender's office to come in and speak to that specific question. So just so we are clear, so no one in the public thinks that I'm misleading them in any shape, form, or fashion, by invitation, we will ask someone from the county attorney's office and someone from the Public Defenders Association to come in and testify to that limited question. Mm-hmm. Anyone else who comes up to testify, that will be made by invitation in order to provide clarity should the committee needs clarity as we are going through the bill in order to see if we can land upon a meeting of the minds.
Time for meeting tomorrow?
I don't know. I will talk to Representative Hoberg because she will have the gavel tomorrow.
Okay.
So hopefully we can do it during a time that will make everyone happy. Okay? With that being said, meeting adjourned.
Where's your gavel?
No gavel, my...